Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
But over the years, I've thought, short of being a doctor or some kind of healer or carer, there's not really a better way of spending your life than making people more cheerful than they were before they listened to or watched the program.
Welcome back to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros. Today, we have the award-winning producer of Blackadder, QI, Spitting Image and Not the 9 o'clock, doing the second part of our unbelievably interesting and wonderful conversation. Please remember to like, subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. When he's not acting as the creative force behind high quality comedy packed programmes, you can hear him as the presenter of BBC Radio 4's The Museum of Curiosity. Throughout his career, he has earned a plethora of BAFTAs for comedy and advertising, plus a Grammy and an Emmy. In 2011, he was appointed Commander of the British Empire for his legendary work producing television and radio. He politely professes to be Professor of Ignorance, but he sure knows plenty about producing a punchline and creating comedy gold. John, thank you so much. We're going to do part two.
It's good to be back, Paul. And I've worn the same tie and shirt as well.
Continuity is everything.
Yeah.
What is the trick? You've worked with, many of, if not most of, the greatest comics of the last 50 years. What is it that their special sauce that makes them different? And have you managed to pick some of that up?
Well, that's what I wanted to do. I set out when I left university, I didn't want to be a lawyer. I thought I'd give myself a year and see if I can make it as a comic in some way. So I used to put on plays and I used to act in those days and put on reviews and do writing in my spare time and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of missed my vocation, and I was actually 61, which is nearly 10 years ago, where I did my first one-man show in Edinburgh, which was terrifying. My wife thought I was going to commit suicide. I was so frightened. But once I got the thing written and I went out in front of the audience, and that month was the best month of my whole life, because I thought, what an idiot. I've been in the wrong job for 40 years. This is what I should have done. This is what I do, because you'll know this, Paul, that going out in front of a lot of people and making them laugh, is there are very few experiences that are more fun than that. It is absolutely life enhancing, both for the audience and for the performer. And it's a public service. It's a joy. It's a very difficult thing to do. But when you do it well, it's just such a positive experience. And
well, it's a drug, isn't it? It's the laugh is the drug, the acceptance, yeah. The thrill, you know.
The endorphins and the sense of, you know, the sense of being alive and being completely there in the moment. And then there's a most peculiar thing that, like anything else, when you're doing it well, you're in the zone. You're sort of not really, you're both there, completely present, and you're absent. You have no ego in that situation. You're
That's
just
really
completely. And I do feel that, not so much with scripted stuff that you've struggled to write and perfect, but when you're ad-libbing, like you might on the radio show, and you come up with a a one-liner and you get a big laugh. That's an interesting thing because I haven't taken credit for ideas. I wouldn't call any of the ideas that I have or that have me for 30 years are mine. They come, nobody knows where ideas come from. It's one of the great mysteries. Humor is a great mystery. Where does it come from? What's it for? Music is another total mystery. We don't really know how it came about or what it's there for. And these mysteries of how you are most yourself when you're not there, when you are completely in the zone, in the state of flow, as they say, that's great. And that when you're funny off the cuff, which is such a pleasant thing, but it catches me by surprise every time. It's not, Stephen Fry once said a great thing. He said, I don't really know what I'm going to say until my lips start moving. And that's the same with being funny, is that actually it's a gift. It comes from the sky, like many songwriters. Harry will always say that. Mozart used to say it. Noel Gallagher said that. Elton John.
Paul McCartney says that. Yeah.
You dream it or it comes to you from some other dimension and you're just simply writing it down. And so again, it's a privilege, and it's one of the things that we should all try and do is be grateful. If you have something like that, to be happy and grateful that you do have it.
As a psychologist, I'm really interested in that because when I work with, I get called in to work with CEOs who have to make big speeches and things like that. And I always say, the first chapter in my first book was called It's All About Them. Because if you are properly connected with the audience, your unconscious can do the work. Because as you probably know, your conscious mind can only hold between 5 and 9 pieces of information at any one time. The unconscious holds millions. And that's when you're at your best, is when you are completely engaged. And that's what the art of, I think, great humor or great comedy is, that you're completely engaged and allowing the unconscious to do the work. And that's where the magic happens, if you like.
I think it's, I've got a slightly different theory to that, which is I did a second one-man show in Edinburgh a couple of years later, and that was about meaning. It was, well, what does it all mean? What's everything? How does it all fit together? And what I think about consciousness is that that really the brain is like a radio. What we think is we're a broadcaster. We're the BBC. We have these ideas. We make stuff. We have ideas, and we're very clever and some. But actually, we're just a radio set, and that's why great art is coming from somewhere else. So it's more like a superconscious. So you're tapped in. Most people who are not creative are sort of blocked off from the universal consciousness, and creative people are sort of sick people who have a hole. There's a hole in the ceiling, as it were, through which the creativity drips. Because the most brilliant people I've ever worked with, Rowan Atkinson is one, Peter Cook was another, they don't ever appear to do any actual work. You know what I mean? Rowan just turns up and is extraordinary. He's extraordinary. It comes, he doesn't really think about it. He thinks a lot, Rowan. He's a very serious-minded guy. But when he's working, it just arrives. And the same with Peter Cook. I never saw Peter Cook pick up a pencil even. He would just have a drink and start talking, and out it would come. It was like I say, he'd got a standpipe into an aquifer, and there would this gusher would come out all day until he went back to sleep again. You know, people often say to me, the reason I'm professor of ignorance at Southampton Solent University is they always ask me to be professor of comedy. And I say, but I don't know anything about comedy. I've been doing it for 45 years and I still don't understand the first thing about how it works. I mean, I know what's not funny. And one of the ironies and paradoxes about my job is most of it is knowing what's not funny and why it's not funny. And then we can start again. Yeah, that's what I do. I'm an editor. I'm an editor with power, I suppose.
That's an amazing talent to be able to do it in the same way that you talked about Rowan and Peter Cook, is that ability to turn off the conscious mind and trust. It's the ultimate trust exercise that I know the funny will come. It's that ability to never go, oh my God, what's next? You're there, you're present, you're completely embroidered, which I don't know if you watched the Beatles documentary, The 8.5 Hours.
I went to the premiere. That was one of the great moments of my life, Paul. So to get asked, because I know the guy who runs Apple in the UK, John O'Clyde, and he's a great friend of mine. So I went with one of our sort of development elf, Dan. So we went to see this. It was a fantastic evening, amazing. And there was an after party to which we got asked. And we're all sort of standing around. Paul McCartney comes in. He's in an incredibly good mood because it's gone really well. And it was a big risk they took. And, you know, nobody knew whether it was going to work. And it worked brilliantly. And so he was in a great mood. And I was standing there with Alan Yentob. Behind me was Stephen Merchant. And Paul comes into the group. And I worked with Paul for 3 days in 1981, I think it was, working on a thing called Rupert and the Frog Song, trying to add extra jokes, me and Terry Jones and Douglas Adams.
Oh, wow.
So I just go over to Paul and I say, hey, Paul, you won't remember me, but he goes, John Lloyd. And I thought, wow, that is what a guy to remember. You know, somebody who was a sort of nobody writer in 1981. From all those years ago, so that was fantastic. But it was an amazing piece of work, I thought.
It's an amazing piece of work. And what I thought was fascinated, and for all our listeners who aren't in music or comedy, I think it translates to how creativity works in any industry, is that they let it happen. They just kept doing it and trusting in the process and being there for each other. And they created an atmosphere that was really comedic and funny, and they're quipping and taking the
piss.
And
I mean, there'll never be another band like the Beatles. I just don't think there's anything to touch them ever.
Well, until Waiting for Smith, obviously.
We had a plugger for a couple of years, a wonderful guy called Jeff, who had worked with Paul McCartney. He's a scouser. Had worked with Paul when he was much younger, and he said compares Harry to Paul McCartney, Paul Simon, because of that thing is that the songs are such a pleasure to listen to, and they keep coming, you know, and they're a bit like, he's also, genre is not something Harry does, you know, he's got all sorts of songs, all different kind of genres, and I was going to say, the other thing is, apart from Essex Builders, the other people who are great with humor at work are musicians. I mean, they love a joke, and their banter in sessions and rehearsals is absolutely terrific. We howl with laughter. And I don't know why they're so connected, you know, humor and music. As a comedy producer, you know you've got a hit when you hear that bands like it. You know, we're not the 9 o'clock news, the Rolling Stones, listen to this, you know, watch this, you know.
Well, I think it's to do with rhythm, to be honest with you, because in order to tell a joke or to do good music, you have to hear the rhythm of the joke. You have to hear, because you've worked with thousands of comedians, as have I, but it's all about, they hear the rhythm. They make the neural, they connect the neural pathways, but they hear the rhythm of it. And I think there's an overlap between them. And frankly, most musicians want to be comedians and most comedians want to be musicians. There is that sort of, and so that bonding in the middle. And I suppose it's ultimately, I think it all comes down to rhythm.
I think that's very, very good. And it's like when you're working on a line, a joke, it's like poetry, or it's like a song, is like, when you get it right, that's what it means. It's right. It's not a matter of opinion. That's right. Those things are not right, and this is right. And I believe that we just haven't worked out the notation for comedy yet. There's no way of, and we still don't really know why things are funny. We know why they're not funny. But there's definitely, as I say, it's like a line of poetry or a hook in a song. It's just correct. That's the end of it. And then there's no arguing.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, when you try and you must have had this with people who aren't naturally funny, and you go, if you leave it an extra beat, it will be funnier. You know, and that's, you know, musical notation in a sense. It's like another beat and it'll be funnier, but some people don't hear that. And that's why it fails to be funny. Well, actually, do you think that everyone on the back of that is potentially funny, or is it a gift given to the few?
Well, I think there's very few people who have no sense of humour. I have met the odd one, but, and obviously I think people are, you know, funnier than, some people are funnier than others. And of course, it depends on the context. You know, some people are very funny in private and not very good, or can't do any sort of public speaking. You know, it's the biggest fear people have, as you'll know, as a psychologist, 50% of Americans would literally rather die than give a speech. They would, you know, they would rather be in the coffin than giving the eulogy.
Jerry Seinfeld. Line, isn't
yeah.
It? Yeah.
I think it's like a lot of things. Is it, unless you catch it young, it's difficult to, I think it's very difficult to, and there are courses on comedy writing, for example. You can't teach somebody to be funny. You can teach them to tidy it up and be more logical and present the work better. But I think, I don't know if it's innate, or I don't think it's something about your early childhood, I think. And I would say that people who are consistently very funny are very unusual. I mean, I would say there are many more top flight brain surgeons in the world than there are top flight stand-up comics, by quite a, by a couple of orders of magnitude, I would say. But there are a lot of, again, it's something that, you know, class, even gender, all this ethnicity, that it has no relevance to whether you're funny or not. I remember once, years ago, so we live in the country, we have an Arga, and a bloke came to fix the Arga, and he worked out that I was a comedy producer, and he said he was a welder in the yards, shipyards, with Billy Connolly.
Oh, wow.
And he said there were 50 blokes who were funnier than Billy. I find that hard to believe, but you can imagine, you know, the banter that went on amongst the welders. And I remember in the days when female stand-ups are very unusual, which is very recent. I mean, it's really only in the last 10 years that there's been an explosion of young women who want to do it. And you even back in the day, 20 years ago, you get criticized for not having enough women. And we'll see, well, there aren't any. You know, the intake at, let's say, the Edinburgh Festival, about 5% of the comics are female. And now it's very nearly 50-50, I think. Something's happened. Whether great comedians like Joe Brand have set an example, I don't know. But women have always been just as funny as men in private. It's in a different kind of way. And that's what always used to puzzle me, is why, if I want a really good laugh, go out to lunch with a bunch of women, you'll have an absolute fantastic time. But very few of them want to get up on stage and do it professionally. And that's changed, which is a very good thing, I think.
Well, I think it's changed because of the bravery, and I use the term advisedly, of Joe Brand, because I started working with Joe at the Comedy Store in Leicester Square. And there were, you know, there were a handful of women, but hardly any of them could properly do the midnight show, where you quite often went on at 2 o'clock in the morning. To, you know, you remember the days where the audience went to heckle, and it was a very tough, and Joe talks about it, in fact, talked about it on this show, that because she was a psychiatric nurse, she said she used to get worse heckles during the day in her day job. So she had that facility to rise above that, but it was very hard. And I think women are nicer to each other, whereas men grow up, you know, chiding each other constantly. And maybe there's something about that gives them a facility later on. I don't know. What do you think?
Difficult to get into gender politics, but I think a lot of men are very disconnected. I think the men that I get on with best, you find out, you within 5 minutes, you think, this guy's either been in therapy, or he's a Buddhist, you know, or he's had a midlife crisis and started thinking about things. Any woman, the average woman, almost all women, the minute they start talking, they're straight into the big stuff, aren't they? You know,
yes.
Illness and children and, you know, the big things. And men are, you know, behind this pathetic cardboard castle of, you know, sport and banter and, you know, trying to pretend you're not unhappy. And it's, again, it's a terrible waste of that being disconnected. And I don't know whether comedy's one way out of that. Because as you said earlier, I mean, comedy is a great thing for joining people up. Music is a great thing for joining people up. You know, conversation should be a great conversation, should be, there's connections all over the place. You know, like the first time we spoke, you think this is ridiculous. We've never met. You know, we seem to, there's so much in common here. And it's something that I certainly do. One of the things that Harry and I share is we like to talk to everybody. You know, if you're talking a minicab driver or bus driver or just a bloke cleaning the street, you know, you talk to anyone. It's extraordinary how much it improves your life, because you just learn these fantastic stories. Everybody has a story, you know, and it just makes you feel better. The fact that you go through life not being frightened of everyone else, but of thinking, I wonder what that person's got to say.
I couldn't agree more. I think that that's in the first time we spoke, we spoke about this. My son, Sam, very similar to Harry, has grown up just going out chatting to anyone being interested, you know, your company's, you know, quite interesting limited. Being interested in other people, I think, is the best way to connect and also get on. For all of our listeners who are thinking, oh, well, what's this got to do with my job or my relationship with my children? I think it's the core of everything. Be interested. I remember being skiing with my friends, and my friends, I went over to the other side and I was chatting to a guy who was sweeping out the bar. And I was there for 45 minutes and they went, what are you doing? I went, this guy's fascinating. He's come from the Slovak Republic and he used to be a professor over there and now he's doing this. And then it's got a fascinating. And by bonding with this person, I got so much. But some people don't realize that you can learn so much, but also get so much more love. And laughter from connecting.
Yes, it's I just don't understand how anybody ever gets bored. I mean, it's just baffling to me that people can be ever bored, that there's so much to think about, so much to look at, so many people to talk to. It's just the ignorance.
Well, we just general ignorance.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness.
If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
No, I want to get back to humour because do you find that you can laugh at yourself easily? And was that always the way? Because you talked about being known as being a Mr. Grumpy earlier. Was it harder to laugh at yourself at that time? And do you think it's important?
Yes, I mean, I think you should laugh at yourself. I'm not sure how good I am at it, actually. It's I think I'm probably quite sensitive to that, and certainly was historically. But yes, we should laugh at ourselves in particular and in general, you know, to not, you know, the current vogue for taking offence at everything rather than, you know, a bit of teasing isn't so terrible most of the time. But, you know, I think it's, well, I think there should be more laughter, you know, everywhere. You know, I think there should be more laughter at work and more laughter, you know, in the family. And you know, my kids will do that thing. Oh, no. I was, when I'm making a point at lunch or whatever, always wave a fork and they all do that. Oh, he's waving his fork again. So I don't mind that. But no, I don't think I do mind when people tease me about things. I'm okay. I think I can probably cope. It's so interesting, the question of whether humour is... My dad died in 2001, and it was really shocking and sudden and surprising. And, you know, I had to organise the first funeral I'd ever done, as I'm the oldest. And I thought for the... after, when we're having the wake, I'll write a speech about him. So I wrote this speech, and I said some very funny things in it. And then just before I was due to give it, I didn't tell anyone I was going to give it, I suddenly realized that all the jokes were against him. They were all about, you know, he's the things that he made mistakes of, falling through the roof when he was trying to shovel snow out of the rafters. And I thought, I can't do this because it sounds like I don't like him, which wasn't at all the case. I was very fond of him, but I just thought they were jokes at his expense. That didn't seem right to me. I don't know why that suddenly occurred to me. I've literally never told that to anyone, I don't think.
But you can do some things which are jokes about, because my father died 6.5 years ago, and I had to do that same thing of writing the eulogy. And it's very much about, it's about them. So you have to bring out their foibles, but it's done with love, isn't it?
The best eulogies I've ever seen are part, you know, that you want the whole person. So we had a memorial for John Sessions the other day. Great, great friend, to go back a long way with him. Brilliant actor, very troubled person, but kind as you like. And all the speeches, he and his lot, was brilliant. Stephen Fry was exceptionally funny. And they were all how much they loved him, how brilliant he was, and what a walking disaster, you know, all his foibles and craziness. And that was what made it so we all loved him despite his ways, you know. Despite that, we still loved him.
Isn't that what makes people special is their idiosyncratic natures and all those things. Isn't that what people are? We love them despite... Nobody's perfect, are they?
No, and I think if when you do meet somebody who appears to be perfect, it's slightly intimidating and a bit weird, frankly.
Yeah.
I remember, so I go on a yoga retreat once a year, which all the family are into yoga because it sort of saved our lives in various ways. And Neville, our yoga teacher, he was a Buddhist monk for 3 years. He's a guy from Oxford, very nice guy. And I thought, this is the closest person I've ever met to someone who's genuinely enlightened. You know, he's kind, he's funny, he's gentle, he's very good at his job, he's just so centered as a person. And then he had kids. And he said, oh, John, and suddenly he's a human being. And now, okay, I can love you completely, Neville, because now, you know, because you can present quite well as a single person, as long as that you're not physically ill and so on. I don't think anyone can do that. As a mother or father, being a parent is a very, very difficult calling, and it's frustrating, and it makes you frightened and angry and all those things. So he's sort of become a much more rounded person now, and he's not intimidating anymore. I was going to say about the yoga thing, interestingly, in terms of laughter being the panacea for everything, is when my wife dragged me along. She did it because she has Meniere's disease, i.e. vertigo. So she's got a balance problem in her ear, and yoga's very good for it. I mean, 15 years ago, she was falling down like a sack of potatoes in the street, and I thought she was not going to be with us for very long. And the yoga has made her, she's still got it, but wow, she can control it. Yeah. And she dragged me along because I was very out of condition, very overweight, drinking too much. I was a mess, and I needed to get a sort of detox. And we started going on these yoga retreats. And because I was, a lot of people in the class were very fit and very good at doing yoga, and I felt ashamed and overweight, and I couldn't do it. I was, you know, giving up, very depressed and cross. And so my defense mechanism was humor. I used to make jokes about it, and mainly against myself. And so I think our yoga class, I'm not saying it's unique, but I've never heard of another one like it. It is incredibly funny. There's a great deal of serious philosophy talked and thoughtful, a lot of kindness and generosity, and lots of jokes. So often the entire class is howling with laughter when they're doing downward dog or something like that. And another thing is, I think another great therapy, I think there should be such a thing, there isn't, is Scottish dancing therapy, which, you know, my wife is a Scot. We go to Scotland every New Year. And I think Scottish dancing has got everything. It's got rhythm, as you said. It's got, you know, it's got music, which is great. It's got fun, which is great. It's got learning, because you're always trying to learn a new set of steps. And of course, because most people are hopeless at it, you laugh a great deal. And there's hugs. I mean, it's got everything. I think if you did Scottish dancing every day, everyone would be just fantastically happy.
Well, there you go. That's our new business, Scottish dancing therapy with Paul and John.
Yeah.
Brilliant. If I asked you to write a business case for humour, what would you include in it, John?
Well, that would be the easiest question, I think, that you've asked me thus far, because I can actually got the facts and figures for this. Okay, so for about 12 years, I've mentioned I was a commercials director. I never wanted to be a director. It looked like a very difficult job to me. Directors I worked with are always shouting and screaming and firing the prop man and having nervous breakdowns and becoming alcoholics and things. And it was obviously the amazing pressure. So, but somebody offered me a job to direct an ad. And after about 4 hours, I thought, rather like doing that one man show I mentioned, I thought, I've wasted my life. I should have been doing this at 20. You know, directing suits me so well. It fits me like a glove. I was never any good as a producer. I'm pretending to be a producer. I hate firing people. I can't read a budget to save my life. Directing, that's great. With actors, I love writers, you know, set designers and problem solving, you know. So after this first one, the second year I was a director, I won a prize for the best ad of the year from a thing called Creative Circle. I couldn't understand how that had happened. And I did some very good stuff, particularly with Barclaycard, with Rowan Atkinson. And one of the things I loved about, because I'd done lots of telly and I wasn't trying to prove anything about my abilities as a director, what interested me about advertising is, how do you sell the product? How do you use the humor as a means to sell what then? I always used to say to the agencies, you know, so what's the brief? And they go, why do you need to know what a brief is? Why don't you just make it funny? I said, no, I need to know, you know, how the bank works, or, you know, what's in the lager, you know, what are they trying to sell? What are they trying to get across? What's the message? They thought I was crazy, but it worked. And I wouldn't claim to be very good at many things, but I was very, very good at the whole business of making ads. Products used to fly off the shelves, and Barclaycard was the apotheosis of this. The first 3 years that I did, they won all the prizes, but it was voted in some magazine the most effective television advertising campaign ever in Britain.
Wow.
And this is how effective it was. The second year, we were out in Bora Bora in Tahiti shooting a couple of ads. The one with the dinghy, if you ever remember that, where he loses binoculars. And there's the one where the doctor's got snake bite on his willy. And two very wonderful ads. We were out there for about 3 weeks. And one night, the account woman had a bit too much to drink and told me how successful the ads were. You don't want to tell the director that because they'll want to charge more money. So, but she got drunk and she said, did you know that these ads are making Barclays Bank £500 million a year that they didn't know they had? £500 million every year. One of the ways it worked is because people would see the ad and they would and laugh, obviously. And when they got their Barclaycard statement, their bill, they go, oh, did you see that one? Did you see the one of the, you know, the guy when he's, you know, going down the lift and this happens, and they forget to pay the bill because they get so talking about the ad, they put the bill aside, and then 6 weeks later, oh my God, and they were paying all this excess interest. Oh, that was one of the ways they did it. And increased the sales, the most expensive credit card in the country, but it increased their sales massively. It used to cost them, I once asked the marketing director, Alan, okay, so basically costing, the ads cost about £500,000 a year to make, two of them usually, or three sometimes. How much do you spend on the media? In other words, buying the media space. He said, oh, about 12 million. So you're basically saying £12.5 million they cost to make, and they're making £500 million. I just worked that out on my calculator last night. That is a return on investment of 4,000%. It's 40 times they were making. So if that isn't a good case for comedy and business, I don't know what is. And I did this a lot. We did a very successful series for Red Rock Cider with Leslie Nielsen. I did Abbey National with Alan Davis for years and years. Harry Enfield and I did some fantastic work for Dime Bar. And product used to just fly off the shelves because it's like, you know, because I was really interested in the clients, used to get on very well with the clients, and, you know, and I would turn up in a suit and the agencies would go, are you mad? I said, look, I'm a public school boy. When I go to a meeting with, you know, 30 people, I wear a suit and tie. That's the way I'm built. I don't wear my leather jacket. It's rude. And so all the marketing guys and women all in their gray suits and so on would think, oh, he's like us. He's actually interested in what's in the lager. You know, he cares about how the car performs. You know, he's not just in it to show off and win prizes. And I found that absolutely fascinating. Again, the problem-solving thing, how do you take this thing that's not selling and make it sell? So there was a very, one very successful I did was for Boddington's beer, takeaway beer, you know, Boddington's. And it was called Boddington's. Do you remember those? The Cream of Manchester?
That's right. So with the Boddington's. No,
that
on
was
the top
one of mine. I did the first one. And it was set, and we made what looked like the coolest New York loft with in Manchester, and it was very, very beautifully designed, and a very funny thing where this woman putting cream on her face, you know, you see her hand go into the beer, and it's, you know, Boddington's, the Cream of Manchester, and then her boyfriend comes in, and he says, "Hey, you smell gorgeous tonight, pet." And then it was done. But what was clever about it was done to make Mancunians look incredibly sexy and cool. And when they used to show this ad in pubs in Manchester, it used to get cheered. And it took the brand from the number 14 takeaway beer in the country to number one, like overnight.
Well, there you go. Funny equals money.
It does, absolutely. Quality absolutely pays dividends, and comedy especially.
Brilliant. Well, we've reached the point in the show where we're going to do quick fire questions.
Okay.
Quick fire questions.
Who's the funniest business person that you've met?
Jimmy Mulville, who runs Hat Trick, very funny. Griff Rhys Jones is an extremely good financial operator and little in his own little way, and is hilarious. One of the best anecdotalists ever. Richard Curtis runs a big thing. He's extremely funny public speaker. I did meet a few sort of chief execs in my time in advertising, but I don't remember. I always remember that if you get right to the top, that person's usually rather wonderful, brilliant, yeah. Got plenty of time, listens, not at all a bully. The middle ranks are often quite difficult. The people at the top are good, but I don't remember them being particularly funny. And then other people, again, I don't know if you call them business, but my bosses at the BBC, David Hatch, who ran comedy and then the whole of radio, was a brilliantly funny man. Jim Moyer, who's still with us, who ran Radio 2 and BBC Light Entertainment for a long time. He's also funny.
David Hatch and I have a connection, which is when I was 11 years old, they wanted ordinary children from ordinary backgrounds, not stage school children, to do a BBC Radio 4 show called From Us to You. Mm. And I was one of the five chosen to do
wow.
it. So I worked with David Hatch and Simon Brett. You know Simon as well?
Simon and, well, Simon's my great friend. You know, I'm a godfather to one of his kids, and he and David were the people who recruited me to the BBC.
What book makes you laugh, John?
Lucky Jim's a very funny book, probably terribly politically incorrect now, I don't know, but I haven't read it for years and years. And, you know, plug my book, The Meaning of Life. I still find that funny.
It's a brilliant book.
That Douglas Adams and I wrote in the early 80s, and that tickles me. But no, I don't. It's a bit of a busman's holiday, reading funny books, you know.
No,
I don't.
Well, no.
And even going to see comedy, I'll go to see, you know, Bill Bailey or Sean Locke, because there was so sad about Sean.
So sad.
But go and see friends to support them, you know, Rob Brydon or Jimmy Carr or whatever. But I wouldn't. Fortunately, somebody else has to go and see all the young up-and-coming comics as their job, which they're happy to do. But I would, you know, I say it's too much like work to me.
No, I get it. You mentioned Jimmy Carr earlier on, who I think proves that fact beautifully, when because he takes very, very difficult topics and approaches them in a way that makes them funny. I think that's a real art. And that's, I just wondered if there was anything personal that you think, but I'm with you. I think if it's approached in the right way, with the right attitude, anything can be funny.
Well, I think Jimmy certainly does that. And what's so amazing about him is that, you know, he makes jokes about Paralympians and they adore him. You know, the thing is, Jimmy's a very good man. I mean, he's a very good friend. He's a great person. He's somebody who's developed very well. He's had his crisis very early in his 20s when he lost his faith and, you know, walked out of his job and went into therapy and rebuilt himself. And he's now, a bit like you, becoming something of a psychologist. You know, he's writing books on how to live better, and he's got a little boy and he's happy. He's the most generous person. You've got to see Jimmy with. I remember he used to be very good friends with Stephen Hawking, most unlikely thing. Yeah. And Stephen used to come to Jimmy's parties, which are the best in London, in his wheelchair with his carer. And, you know, obviously he looked as he looked. But when Jimmy went to speak to him, his eyes twinkled like little diamonds. It was so, and his little smile came on his face. It was so moving. And Jimmy would, you know, tease him, make yeah. jokes, you know.
That's yeah. well, that's beautiful, isn't it? Because actually, when you know you are very close to a person, you can tease, you can chide, you can play with somebody, and people yeah. love it because it's done in the right spirit.
I've seen, for 10 years, I was the sort of, a talent booker for a show we put on at the New Theatre in Oxford in aid of a children's hospice called Helen Douglas House. And I used to, you know, pull strings to get Rowan and Jimmy and people like that. And I remember how kind Jimmy was to ordinary people, who particularly, you know, disabled people or kids or whatever. He's always got the time, and he treats everybody exactly the same. Friendly, teasing, respect.
Beautiful.
But I was going to share with you this thing. You've probably never even seen this. We did this book. Richard Curtis and I put this together for Comic Relief at the Definitive Blackadder Books with... And it's got all the scripts in there, but I did the bits in the middle, which are the little extra bits. And talking about silly words, this is Prince Regent's, you know, a bit of a fop, as you know, Hugh Laurie's Prince Regent.
Yeah.
His laundry list. Turtle and Son, Gentlemen's Launderers and Sprucers, 3 Bun Lane, Clerkenwell. So this, and it's got all these guys. So you've got Sporrans, none. Kimonos Informal, 3, Kimonos Foul Weather, Shoulderettes, 3, Scanties, 44, Folderols, 2, Skimpies, 9, Underskimpies, 9, Overskimpies, 4, Arbroath Smokies, Halterneck Swagger Flopsies, Whoop-a-Daisies, Bossom Hearties, Log Warmers, Boleros, Bobby Knickers, Varsity Roasters, Rap Rascals, Bunny Lariats, Todgerellos, Billows, Bufflers, Bung Nasties, Ossops, Otter Tops, Hair Shirts, nil. Sarongs, 4, Squeamishes, 9, Under Squeamishes, 8, Squirters, Dinner Dirndls, Night Panties, Club Dorises, Slip Goslings Fur, Slip Goslings Tweed, Blouses, 52, Chemises, Chive Clamps, Hug Bunters, Dress Nancies, Swallow Breasted Portscathos, Scugs, 50, Scrotals, 10, Nipple Loops, 2. It just goes on. That makes me laugh. It's just kind of pathetic.
Complete. Oh, it's superb. Absolutely superb. Oh, God, that is hilarious. What sound makes you laugh?
What sound?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that when I was very small, when I said I first went to prep school, and I was sort of, you know... Quite shy, I suppose, and I had to read out something in geography which contained the expression wood pulp. It was about, you know, logging in Canada or something, and I mispronounced it as wood plup. And I just completely lost it. I couldn't stop laughing for the whole of the rest of the lesson. I don't know why the sound of plup makes me laugh.
The sound of plup, which is a lovely album. And
plup.
Yes. The name of Waiting for Smith's new album, Sound of
Plop. Yeah.
Two grown men giggling. And finally, Desert Island Gag number 2, if you'd be so kind.
Well, this is my current favourite, because it's sort of quite topical, and it's about this... two old couples who've just come out of lockdown, and they're going for a walk in the park. And one old chap says to the other, he said, we went out to had a delightful evening, the missus and I, the other night. We went to this, I believe they're called gastro pubs. He said, oh, very nice. Yes, he said, a very very pleasant, congenial atmosphere, excellent food, and very good company. Indeed, I would highly recommend it. And the other chap says, oh, well, and what is the name of this establishment, if I may ask? And the chap says, oh, dear. Oh, dear, now it's gone. It's gone quite... You have to help me out. It's gone quite out of my head. I can't remember. He says, it's like a flower. Which is like, and it's got these like often red and white, sometimes pink, and it's got these like thorns sticking out the side, isn't it? What's that? And the guy says, oh, well, that'd be a rose, wouldn't it? He says, yeah, thanks very much. He says, Rose, what was the name of that restaurant we went to the other night?
Oh, absolutely superb. John Lloyd, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on the Humorology podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great fun.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.